In Romans chapter 1, Paul says, "For I'm not ashamed of this good news about Christ. It is the power of God at work, saving everyone who believes, the Jew first, and also the Gentile." The good news. This is the message that basically God did the incredible, the unthinkable, to come into the world that he created through the person of Jesus of Nazareth to pay for every single person's sin, man, woman, boy, and girl. What's our part? Everyone who believes. So that's true. That's something that happens, but you just have to trust that. You believe that it's true and accept it for yourself. And the Bible says that there's no discrimination here. You know, Jew or Gentile, male, female, doesn't matter. Everybody's welcome, provided you come on God's terms. Then he said, this good news tells us how God makes us right in his sight. Maybe you've heard people say that. You know, how do I get right with God? I need to get right with God. Well, this is how. This is accomplished from start to finish by faith. That's what God wants. What does he want from me? Oh, he wants you to clean up, man, clean up your act. Oh, you can't be living like that. Well, that's not how it starts. That's not how it continues. That's not how it finishes. The whole thing is by faith. It's by trust. Trusting in Christ. And all of a sudden, once you do that, that's how you get right with God, and that's how he starts to change your life to become more like him, more loving. He concludes, as the scriptures say, it is through faith that a righteous person has life. Then we read this in verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of people who, by their unrighteousness, suppress the truth about God." So remember, Paul had never been to Rome, and so he's starting right from the beginning. God, what do you think about God? What about people who have never heard the Bible before? Never heard about God, what about them? Well, Paul says it's actually, these people have heard something. And what have they heard? Well, he says, "For that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them." This word for evident is phaneru, phaneron. This means to be revealed. So sometimes you'll hear theologians say things like, this is general revelation. Specific revelation would be like in the person of Jesus or in the Bible. Like if you pick up your Bible, that's specifically being revealed to you, what God wants. This is general revelation, that even if you never had a Bible, you never heard about Jesus, just from this, you'd be able to infer that there's a God. That's what Paul says here. He says, "For God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made." So just like if I had, you know, a painting up here, you wouldn't be able to see the artist. You wouldn't be able to see the painter. And yet you would know that that artist has certain attributes. There's something about the artist that you'd be able to glean from the painting. You wouldn't know everything about the artist. You wouldn't know his or her age, their political affiliation, their ethnicity. You wouldn't know any of that. But you at least know, okay, I know that a bunch of ants didn't make that painting. I know it must be some kind of personal being. And the same thing is true of the material universe. That's what Paul's saying. That just looking out at the canvas of the universe, even though we can't see God, we can see the creation. And from that, we can make inferences about what the Creator must have been like. This is so strong, according to Paul, he says that we are actually without excuse. This term, anapologetos, literally means without a rational defense. Josephus, the New Testament authors, used the word apologia to describe a legal defense in a court of law. This is an anapologetos. This is without a legal defense. One area that we could see is the area of fine-tuning. This is a subject that really got its headlines back in 1974. Brandon Carter published a paper which showed that there was this area in the constants of nature that needed to be finely tuned. And all of a sudden, physicists of all stripes started to come together to discuss this area of fine-tuning with regard to the laws, the constants, and the initial conditions of the universe. And what they discovered is if these laws and constants and initial conditions were off by just even a hair's breadth, just infinitesimally small, we wouldn't live in a life permitting universe. We would live in a life prohibiting universe. There would be no life, there would be no planets, there would be no galaxies, there would be no stars. But the fact that these laws, constants, and initial conditions lined up just right, it gave us a life permitting universe. So I'd like to show you a little video we put together here on this subject from some of the top physicists of the day. These are all agnostic physicists. They're not believers in God, so why don't you check this out here.
All right, let's talk about one of them, though, that has some particular strangeness to it, the so-called cosmological concept.
That's right. That's the one which is really on the knife edge, okay? It is on such a narrow knife edge that it's almost inconceivable if you were to change it just the tiniest, tiniest bit, we couldn't be here. This constant, whatever made the universe, I hate to say whoever you made the universe, physicists have a habit of talking in that language, whoever made the universe. They don't really mean it. But whoever made the universe made it with an incredibly small, tiny cosmological constant. It is so small that it is 0.000000. We can sit here for a while. 123 of them.
And then a one.
And then a one. I think it's actually a two. But it is incredibly small, and nobody really knows why. So if it were just a little bit bigger, just a little bit bigger than this 0.000000, it would have prevented our existence. Physicists have never understood why it's so small. On the other hand, this cosmological constant is tuned to one part and 10 to the 120, 120 decimal places. Nobody thinks that's accidental. That is not a reasonable idea, that something is tuned to 120 decimal places just by accident.
So, in all of these cases, with the electron mass, with the proton mass, with the cosmological constant, which is vacuum energy, the only explanation that we have right now of these coupling constants is that if they would be much different, then our life would be impossible.
And there's also the gravitational fine structure constant, which is tiny. It's 10 to the minus 40. And so the reason it's so tiny compared to the electric fine structure constant means that the gravitational force between two protons, for example, is 10 to the minus 38 times smaller than the electric force. Now, a lot of the coincidences, the anthropic tunings, involve these dimensionless coupling constants. It seems we need both types of stars in our universe, but the only reason they exist is because of this remarkable fine tuning, which says the gravitational fine structure constant is the 20th power of the electric fine structure constant.
It's certainly the case, and I think this is now uncontroversial, that if the laws of physics were very slightly different in almost any way, there could be no life in the universe, no complex chemistry, and no thinking people, and therefore no one who knows the laws of nature. So they are somehow almost infinitely special in that they allow themselves to be, as you said, not just known but also used, and that they were used before humans even existed to create life and then for the human species to evolve.
But what we seem to find in the universe that we know is this and this. That is, it was very uniform, and with regard to the matter, okay, it was maximum entropy, but with regard to gravitation, it was very, very special. How special was it? You can actually work this out. It's so special that the odds against the special initial state coming about by chance are less than one part in 10 to the power 123. So if you try to write this out, 100000, with this number of zeros, you'd try to put one zero in every particle in the observable universe, you'd be way short. You'd never do it that way. That's not enough room to put all the zeros in. So I could do it by using two exponents, you see, but that's cheating, if you like. I just want to give you some feeling for how special the initial state of the universe was. And for some reason, people, you know, they try and say, well, you don't want such and such a theory or so and so a theory because that requires fine tuning or something like that. Well, there's got to be fine tuning. This is fine tuning. This is incredible precision in the organization of the initial universe.
All right. So that gives you kind of a primer on what we're talking about here. And again, as I said, this is affirmed by agnostic and atheistic physicists. You're like, well, like who? Like everybody. Even Richard Dawkins is on this list. He's an ardent atheist. And tonight, I'm not going to quote from any Christian authors. I'm not going to quote from any even believers in God. I'm kind of going to argue this case with one arm tied behind my back, so to speak. This is not Christian science. This is just real material physical sciences. John Barrow, he's an agnostic research professor at Cambridge, he says there could be no imaginable forms of life at all. Now, there is one person who disagrees with this. This is Dr. Ian Malcolm. He's a mathematician at the University of Texas at Austin. He disagrees. I brought a little clip just to be fair.
It's not possible. Listen, if there's one thing the history of evolution has taught us, it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, it expands to new territories, and it crashes through barriers painfully, maybe even dangerously, but life finds a way.
I love Jeff Goldblum so much. You're like, why'd you put that in there? Jeff Goldblum, that's why. Now, people agree on this. This is the consensus today. How many examples of fine-tuning are we talking about here? Let's go through just a few of them. The mass of the neutron. This is tuned to one part in 700. Now, if the neutron were a tenth of a percent more massive than it is, there'd be no heavy elements in the universe, which are necessary for life. If it was a tenth of a percent less massive, we would only have neutron stars and black holes. Boy, that worked out pretty well. The epsilon constant, the strong nuclear force constant, this is tuned to the thousandth decimal place, 0.007. If it was 0.006, we would have no hydrogen. We could not exist, according to Martin Rees. If it was 0.008, no hydrogen. We couldn't exist. The strong nuclear force, one of the four fundamental forces. The weak nuclear force, this is tuned to one part in 10,000. That's pretty high. That wouldn't be very good odds. If this wasn't finely tuned this way, exquisitely, we would have no supernovae. That's the plural for supernova. Supernovae, which contain heavy elements for life. The uniformity of the cosmic background microwave radiation. This is uniform throughout the universe, that it's 2.7 Kelvin, 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, and it's uniform. This is tuned to one part in 100,000. If this wasn't the case, if it was decreased, there'd be no stars, no planets. If it was increased, no stable orbits for planets to eventually produce life. The ratio of matter to antimatter, one part in 10 billion. So at the early universe, you had matter and antimatter on the order of 10 billion to 10 billion in one. Matter and antimatter annihilated each other, produced all of this energy, and then that little bit extra was the amount of matter left in the universe. If it was perfectly symmetrical, if it wasn't finely tuned to one part in 10 billion, we would have no matter. The ratio of electrons to protons. This is tuned to one part in 10 to the 36th power. That's a one with 36 zeros after it. If this wasn't finely tuned, no galaxies, no stars, no planets, just extremely diffuse gas. That's all we'd have. The N constant. This is electromagnetism to gravity. This is tuned to one part in 10 to the 37th. A one with 37 zeros after it. Are you getting the picture here? If this was increased, we'd have no small stars. Now, you need small stars like ours to give a slow, stable burn to create planets that are equitable for life of any kind. If it was decreased, you would have no large stars. You're like, well, why do we need large stars? Well, these produce the most amount of carbon and oxygen in the universe. We need that. Carbon-based life. Carbon is easily the simplest element on the periodic table to be able to combine with the others. I've heard some people say, oh, well, we could have silicone-based life. Okay, carbon can combine with so many of the other different elements that it can produce 29,000 different chemical compounds. Silicone, 43. So to say here, it's also very stable, very good for life. Just to give you an example, CO2, carbon and oxygen. One part carbon, two parts oxygen. Gives you carbon dioxide. If you were to replace carbon with silicone, it wouldn't give you carbon dioxide. You know what it'd give you? Sand. Gives you a crystal. That's what we're talking about. So people are like, well, maybe there's silicone-based life. If you include that, that just makes the probabilities even worse than what we were starting with in the first place. Gravity compared to the weak force. This is tuned to one part in 10 to the 50th power. If it was larger, no galaxies. If it was smaller, the universe would have collapsed into a big crunch. No life in there. A big black hole. Dead. The omega constant. This is the mass density of the universe. This is also sometimes referred to as the expansion rate of the universe, the expansion at which the Big Bang blew. This is tuned to one part in 10 to the 55th power. That's an incredible figure. 55 zeros. If the expansion was just one part stronger, no galaxies or stars, if expansion was weaker, the universe would have collapsed. To put that in perspective, this would be like adding the mass of a dime to the material universe. That's one part in 10 to the 55th power. That's how finely tuned this needs to be. The lambda constant, the cosmological constant, this is sometimes referred to as dark energy or vacuum energy. We've noticed that the universe isn't decelerating but accelerating. Ever since 1998, we've discovered that the stars are actually moving away quicker. As we saw in that video, this is tuned to one part in 10 to the 120th power. That's a 1 with 120 zeros after it. If this was larger, the universe would consist of a hydrogen and helium soup. That wouldn't be good for life. And then the helium, we'd all be talking really high. So that'd be embarrassing. The low entropy state of the universe. This one we mentioned in the video. This is tuned to 10 billion raised to the 123rd power. This is a number, is Penrose said. Now, he's an Oxford scholar. He's buddies with the late Stephen Hawking. Penrose said, if you were to put a zero on every subatomic particle in the universe, you wouldn't have enough particles to write that number. Just to write the number, not the odds, just to write the number. Lewis and Barnes, Luke Barnes is a Christian. He wrote this book, A Fortunate Universe, with an atheist, his friend. They basically collaborated on the first seven chapters on the science. So all the science, they're like, we agree on that. It's the eighth chapter where they start to pull out their knives and try to go after each other. Lewis and Barnes say to write that number, you wouldn't just need every subatomic particle with a zero on it. You would need 10 to the 43 universes with every particle with a zero to write that figure. An incomprehensible fine-tuning. Without this, no galaxies, no stars, no planets. You getting the idea? Well, how many of these are there? There's roughly 30 laws, constants, and initial conditions. This comes from agnostic Paul Davies' book, The Goldilocks Enigma. You get the title? Not too heavy, not too light, not too hard, not too soft, just right. That the universe has to have these constants just right, just perfectly right for it to work. Now, some people say, well, what about chance? You are saying it's one part in 10 to the 37th or one part in 10 to the 55th. So there is a chance. I've heard people say that. I'm like, dude, I don't think you speak English. No. That's not the case here. It actually reminds me of this clip from a video I watched years ago.
I'd say more like one out of a million.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
When we watched that movie, Dumb and Dumber, we laughed. Because what is the woman trying to communicate? One out of a million, we'd ever get together. Jim Carrey says, you're telling me there's a chance. And we laughed because we're like, one out of a million, that's silly. We're not talking about one out of a million. We're talking about incomprehensible fine-tuning here. No, chance is not an explanation for this. All right. Let's just try and explain this here. Let's drill down a little bit closer. Let's think about the gravitational constant. Here is the equation. Okay, the G is the gravitational constant. M1 would be the mass of one object. Let's say it's the Earth. M2 would be the mass of a second object. Let's say it's the Moon or the Sun. This is multiplied together with G, divided by the distance between those two objects. So all of these could be variables. M1 could be me, M2 could be the moon. M1 could be the sun, M2 could be another star. The radius, the distance between its square, that's all variable. But this figure here, G, this is the constant. This is the thing that never changes, no matter where you measure it, between any two objects, any distance. And this has this figure, G is just this number. And this is tuned to one part in 10 to the 40th power. Just to give you that written out, that's 40 zeros. 40. Now let's just try and capture what we're saying here. Okay, let's say you're feeling really lucky. You go into the gas station and you buy your ticket for the Powerball. That's the Mega Million. That is the one where you're going to cash in, probably retire not just yourself, but your kids and your grandkids. This is the big one, baby. What's the chances of you winning this? 300 million. That's the lottery, for that, the biggest lottery that we can think of. What about the number of cells in your body? Like, what if somebody said, we've got a procedure here that if we take out one of the cells, it could save your life, but we have to do it blindly. What would that be? Well, that would be 37.2 trillion cells. That would be the odds to get the right cell out of your body by blind chance. That doesn't even come close to 10 to the 40th. What about the number of seconds that the material universe has existed? Let's say 13.6 or 13.7 billion years ago. That is 10 to the 18th seconds. That's how many seconds the universe has been around. That doesn't even come close. All right, let's just try and get in a little bit better here. Let's imagine we have a God's eye view of the universe. We also just happen to have a God's Stanley tape measure. And this stretches across the entire length of the universe. And it's divided up into inches. To be off by a single inch, to be 1 inch stronger on that timeline, or on that length, to be 1 inch stronger on that scale, that would be life prohibiting, no life. To be 1 inch weaker, no life. It has to be the Goldilocks effect right in the middle, just right. Wait a minute, that doesn't quite figure out. That doesn't even compare to the number we're talking about. 10 to the 40th power, that's only 10 to the 28th power. That's how many inches go across the material universe. Some 20 billion light years. Okay, let's try harder. Imagine we're in a space shuttle looking down at the Earth, and we cover the entire North American continent with dimes. Looks something like this, all right? And we take the dimes, now let's just scratch everything we know about physics, and we take the dimes and we fill them all the way up, we stack them all the way up to the moon, a distance of 239,000 miles. You're like, what would that even look like? I got you. Okay, it would look like that. So we've got our dimes stacked up all the way to the moon. Now let's do this on a billion other continents. You getting the idea? Paint one of these dimes red. Blindfold somebody. Just get them to the right continent. Okay? Just getting there would be good. That'd be one in a billion. Then getting them to pick out the dime from the 239,000 mile stack of dimes the size of North American continent, the continental United States. That would only be 1 in 10 to the 37th power. That doesn't even match up. Now, I hope you realize 10 to the 37th going up to 10 to the 38th is 10 times 10 to the 37th. 10 to the 39th, 100 times. 10 to the 40th, 1,000. So really, this would be stacking it on a trillion different continents, raising it to 10 to the 40th. That's how you'd have to get there. Let's think of another constant, the mass density of the universe, or the expansion rate of the universe. This is tuned to one part in 10 to the 55th power. Now, instead of thinking linearly, let's think geometrically. Let's think about the entire universe all around. The odds of this would be like hitting a 1-inch target at the other end of the observable universe with a gun. Now, that's the odds. Some people would say, well, man, I'm pretty macho. I bet I could hit it. First of all, no. Second, that's not the point. The point is you'd have to do this by chance. Otherwise, that would be what we call intelligent design, that a designer shoots something and has agency and has a will. That's how you'd be able to do it. But you'd have to do this blindfolded. So this raises the question for physicists, you know, how do we explain this? We have an incomprehensible amount of fine-tuning. Chance does not explain it. Physical necessity does not explain it. These numbers did not need to be the way that they are. They could have been different. Yes, they could have. And we're moving through multiple different ways, laws, constants, initial conditions. These are actually different areas. And so how do we explain this? Well, the current theory, which is above all theories in the astrophysics community, is that we don't live in a universe, like one verse, like a unicycle has one cycle, but we live in a multiverse. This is considered to be that we live in all of these different universes. We're in one universe, but there are all of these different universes out there. Some people say that they're in different dimensions. That's one theory. Not that popular. Most think that there are all these bubble universes that are beyond the scope, what they call the event horizon of our universe, that we can't even in principle see them. But there's an infinite number of universes out there. Now, if you've got an infinite number of universes, even if you have 10 to the 37 multiplied by 10 to the 55th or 10 billion to the 123rd, if you have an infinite number of universes, eventually one of those is going to be just right for life. Let's think about it with that Powerball illustration. You'd say, well, it's really unlikely that I would pick a person and say, you're going to win the Powerball next week. Well, that would be unlikely. But would it be unlikely if we said there were, I don't know, 60 million people playing? In that case, that would change the probability. If you got enough people out there, somebody is bound to win the Powerball. The same thing would be true with fine-tuning. If you've got multiverses, multi-universes, then one of these would have to be the jackpot. Well, I remember hearing this for the first time. Super intrigued. Wow, we live in a universe and we're surrounded by an infinite number of other universes. That's got to be the coolest freaking thing I've ever heard. And I started reading on this. Wow, wow, wow. And I was like, man, I wonder what the evidence is for this. Guess what I found out? None. Zero. Zilch. Not even in principle could you have that. There's nothing testable here. Nothing. George Ellis, in his scathing article in Scientific American, just says, even in principle, we couldn't. Martin Rees, who's a multiverse supporter, this is his theory. He says we couldn't even in principle detect these other universes. Oh, I've read the headlines, you know, recently in a, you know, science.com or whatever. They'll have a headline that says gravitational wells. They show evidence for the multiverse. What they don't tell you is that those same things show evidence in a universe. It's equal either way. There's nothing out there that is showing empirical evidence. This is completely blind faith. Secondly, this doesn't pass what we call, this is a philosophical principle called Occam's razor. William of Ockham was a philosopher and a theologian, and he was quoted as saying that we should multiply causes beyond necessity. It isn't what you see in sitcoms and stuff or CSI where they're like, oh, the simplest explanation is the right one, Occam's razor. That's stupid. No. We shouldn't multiply causes beyond necessity. You know, it could be the case that if you came across a dead body and it had, you know, 12 stab wounds in it, it could be the case that 12 different murderers each stabbed the person once. That's possible. But we shouldn't multiply causes beyond necessity. If you've read Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, that's the end of the book. Is, you know, Monsieur Poirot discovers it was 12 killers stabbed the guy one time. It's a pretty cool book. Anyways, it was a twist ending because you wouldn't expect that. Why? Because of Occam's razor. You would expect it'd be one killer stabbing him 12 times, not 12 killers who each stab him once. Occam's razor. Why would this go against Occam's razor? Because in order to get rid of one God, you need an infinite number of universes. That is multiplying causes way beyond necessity, far beyond. Furthermore, if there is an actual infinite number of universes, oh, that leads to so many different problems. I'm not talking about a progressive infinite. That's where you're counting in succession toward infinity. That's possible. I'm talking about an actual infinite set of something. It can't exist. It exists in math, conceptually, in the mind. Actual infinite numbers of things don't exist in reality. Let me illustrate this. If there's an infinite number of universes, let's say each of these universes has two galaxies. So how many galaxies are there in total? An infinite number. Well, what if each universe had 10 galaxies? Or how many galaxies would there be total? Infinite. What if each one of these infinite universes had 100 galaxies? How many galaxies would there be? An infinite number. What if each of these universes had a person named James Rochford in them? How many James Rochfords would there be? Infinite. What if half of them, those James Rochfords, that's my name, by the way, what if half of them were wearing red shirts? How many James Rochfords would you have? An infinite number. What if we subtracted 3 from the number of James Rochfords in those universes? How many would we have? An infinite. You see the problem? Actual infinities lead to absurdities. These work in conceptual frameworks, not in reality. Furthermore, the multiverse theory proves way too much. Why would you say that? Because if you're going to use this to argue against fine-tuning and all the statistical probability there, what you've done is proven too much. This means that we would have to get rid of all probability theory. Bayesian probability is out the window at this point. Because you can't just apply it to fine-tuning, you'd have to apply it to everything. So imagine sitting down with a buddy and you're playing poker for $1,000 a hand, and he deals himself a royal flush. And you're like, whoa, that's kind of odd. That's, what is that, 1 in 650,000 odds to get a royal flush? Whoa, but it's your buddy, and so you're like, okay, well, you happen to do it. You give him $1,000. Same thing on the second hand. Same thing on the third hand. Same thing on the fourth hand and the fifth hand. And finally you get up to the eighth hand and you're like, wait a minute, something's funny here. You're out $8,000 and you go to slug your buddy in the mouth and he says, whoa, 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 dude. If there are an infinite number of universes, yeah, it's improbable, but we just happen to be in the one where I dealt myself 8 royal flushes in a row. We would have to get rid of all kind of probability theory. It would go completely out the window. If you answered for this, it answers everything. So it's an acid that would eat everything away. Other people I've talked to, they said, well, string theory. So I'm like, what's that? You know, well, it's, strings are basically the fundamental, not particles. There aren't particles. It's these vibrating strings. They're circular in a loop. And at the base are these vibrating strings. In string theory, they predict that there are 10 to the 500th power different hypothetical universes. So this isn't the multiverse. This is what they call the cosmic landscape of possible universes with different figures. And so if this were true, this might be able to capture a theory of everything, to put together gravity with electromagnetism and the weak and the strong force. This would be like a TOE, the toe, the theory of everything is what they call it. String theory. And so maybe this could answer fine-tuning. Not even in the closest. First of all, string theory is sinking faster than the Titanic. It is in such bad shape. Recently, they discovered that most of these universes in string theory, hypothetical, not real, most of these are mathematically inconsistent. I mean, they just had a seminar on this last year, 2018, that showed most of these won't even work. Furthermore, there's no astronomical or experimental evidence for this, for string theory. And I love people talking about this. Well, super string theory or M theory. This is where you put all the different string theories together into M theory. Yeah. What's the evidence for that? None. There is none. And even if there were, what this would do is, this would change our constants, which are finely tuned, into initial conditions, which need to be finely tuned. This would just change the problem and really move it back a step. Wouldn't get rid of fine tuning. The worst part about string theory is that it contradicts the cosmological constant, which is the consensus in physics today. Believe me when I tell you, physicists would love to get rid of the cosmological constant. In fact, there's a paper I cited in here. The title of the paper is The Disturbing Implications of the Cosmological Constant. This was written decades ago. At the end of the paper, they said maybe there is no cosmological constant. They'd love to get rid of it. It's here to stay. Dark energy is real. It's observable. It's testable. Here's Clara Moskowitz. This is from 2018, Scientific American. Commenting on string theory, she says, most, if not all, of those universes are actually forbidden, at least if we want them to have stable dark energy, the supposed force accelerating the expansion of the cosmos. Yeah, it's not supposed. The vast majority of the solutions found so far are mathematically inconsistent. So that's interesting. That would mean instead of 10 to the 500, most of these wouldn't even exist, which would mean the probabilities are still way too high. putting them not in the cosmic landscape, but in the so-called swampland of the universe that cannot actually exist. So far, all astrophysical evidence supports the cosmological constant idea. This is the thorn in the side of string theory. Man, it's going down. String theory lacks any experimental evidence supporting it. And even worse, any reasonable prospects for gathering such evidence. See, that's a difficulty. No evidence, and we don't even know where to start. We don't even know how to test it out. Let's just say it's true. Let's say that string theory unifies the four fundamental forces of nature. Gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear forces. Let's just say it's true. Would that get rid of fine-tuning? Not at all. Because then the problem would be, how do you have a theory of everything that itself is finely tuned? Here's Martin Rees of Cambridge. He writes, even if all apparently anthropic, human-centered, life-permitting coincidences could be explained by unified theory of physics or theory of everything, it would still be remarkable that the relationships dictated by physical theory happened also to be those propitious for life. Even, and I hope we do, find this theory of everything, it's not going to get rid of fine-tuning one iota. Not at all. And so that leaves us with Romans 1:20. I don't think this is really all that complicated. We don't need a multiverse. We don't need a string theory. What would you need to have fine-tuning in the material universe? It seems to me you'd need a fine-tuner. Some people have said, well, maybe it was aliens. Dude, come on. Aliens would be in the universe, right? We're talking about the fine-tuning of the universe. This would imply that you would need something or someone outside of space and time, outside of matter and energy, and incomprehensibly brilliant and powerful to fine-tune the laws, constants, and initial conditions to make it satisfying for a life-permitting universe. Another way of putting that is God. You need God. An infinite personal being. Yeah, you could either have an infinite number of universes or one single infinite personal God. Well, as we wrap up here tonight, I'd like to ask yourself the question that was really raised in the beginning of this chapter, wasn't it? Is the problem for you when you think about faith, that just means trust, to trust yourself to Christ. Is the problem for you that you lack evidence for that? Or is the problem that you're really suppressing the evidence? I can speak for myself here. I remember I was not always a Christian. I was an atheist. And I remember seeing some of these evidences and it really bugging me. And really, in an extravagant way, looking for the loopholes. Where's the problem? Where's the leak in the argument? And looking very hard to find out, what could be wrong with this? Really in a peculiar way. I remember feeling really uncomfortable by this. Not really sure why, but it bothered me that there could be a God. I remember thinking to myself, well, maybe I should pray. Maybe if I pray, I call out to God. If I did that, I don't know if I want to do that. Actually, I think that kind of scared me. I don't know what scared me more. The thought that I would call out to him and nothing would happen. Or maybe the thought I'd call out to him and I'd hear something back. Well, I did that. Back in May of 2004, I remember praying to him. I showed up the next week, nothing. Next month, nothing. Kept looking in the clouds, maybe there'll be like a sign up there or something. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And I just forget it. I'm going to move to Ohio State, drink, chase girls, play music, maybe get a degree at the same time. I don't know. And lo and behold, within the first couple weeks, I met this guy who was a sharp, intelligent Christian who invited me out to a Bible study. It wasn't until way later I started to realize that was the answer to prayer. If I had seen, I'm real, sign G-O-D in the sky, what would that really have done? But to have a guy who became my friend, who loved me, brought me out to get my questions answered, oh man, that was way better. If you're here tonight and you have that sense of tension, I just want to be crystal clear with you. Come to Christ. Surrender to the love of God. There's nothing to fear here. Just accept the love of God in your heart. You wouldn't believe what this is like. Just finally just say, okay, I call it quits. I want to accept you. I want to know you and receive the gift of Christ. Do that here with us tonight. Very simple. I'm not saying it's easy, but very simple. It's not easy because you have to lower your pride. You have to say, I can't do it on my own. I need Jesus to do it for me. But if you're ready to do that, John explains this very clearly. He says in John 1:12, as many as received Jesus, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. What are the verbs here? Received, gave, and become. If you receive Jesus into your heart, God will give you the right to become one of his children. You could have that here tonight. And we're going to pray here in a little bit. If that's something you feel led to do, that's something you could just do. Just you and God. Nobody else. Just you and him in your heart. And just pray and just say, I want that for me. This is really true. I want that for me. Well, that's all we had for tonight. At this point, what we'd like to do is kind of kick it open to the floor. Because we like to hear what you guys have to think. Why don't we start down here, and then we'll go back over here. Yeah.
Are those related to each other, or are those independent? Like, if the strong force was up one and the weak force was down one, would they balance each other out, or are they kind of independent of each other?
Great question. Victor Stenger, the late Victor Stenger, who was an atheist, he wrote the book The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning. And the central premise of the book was that we're only moving one of the constants or laws or initial conditions, and we're not considering the others at the same time. Luke Barnes and Geraint Lewis say this is one of the most persistent myths of fine-tuning. Nobody does that in physics. They all agree that if you move the gravitational force or the weak force or the cosmological constant up or down, it will have an effect on the others. And so, but that only multiplies the issues. Luke Barnes, if you want a good article, he has surveyed 200 of the peer-reviewed physical journals and articles on fine-tuning, and he shreds Victor Stenger. I mean, it is embarrassing the way he goes through and shows the fallacies of his book, The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning. So, yeah. Okay, let's go over here.
Say in response to someone who's like, okay, multiverse theory, okay, maybe that doesn't hold water, string theory doesn't hold water, but why not chance, right? We can't experience the non- or the prohibiting universes anyway, so we must be in the one that allows life.
This is referred to as the weak anthropic principle. And it goes like this. We shouldn't be surprised to be in a life-permitting universe. Why? Because if we were in a life-prohibiting universe, we'd be dead. Well, this is in philosophy what they call a tautology. It doesn't prove anything. It just basically proves itself. It's self-referential. It doesn't prove anything outside of itself. And to show the fallacy, there's a philosopher by the name of John Leslie who gives an illustration. And the illustration is this, that you're a captive in a time of war, and you're brought out in front of a string of 100 marksmen with rifles, and you're lined up against the wall, and you have a blindfold over your eyes, and the captain of the guardsmen says, "Ready, men, aim, fire!" And you hear the barrage of the rifles, and you're just sitting there, you know. They untie your hands. You feel yourself, not a scratch, except for you wet your pants, right? You look back at the wall, it's just a silhouette of your body. So the guy in the illustration goes back shaking to his bunk with his cellmate, and he's up all night, man. He's pacing back and forth thinking to himself, what could have happened? Maybe they were all drunk. Maybe that's what it was. No, that wouldn't make sense. One of them would have hit me. Maybe they had blanks in their guns. No, because there was the outline of the silhouette of the bullet holes. Maybe our comrades came in and somehow paid them off not to kill me. No, that's not possible, because why wouldn't they just bust us? And, you're thinking up theory after theory after theory. And finally, the cellmate turns to the guy and he says, "Hey, stop arguing about this with yourself. If one of them had hit you, you wouldn't be alive to be thinking about it. Now go to sleep." Now, that's true. If one of the marksmen had shot the prisoner, he wouldn't be alive to think about the vast improbability. But that's not what happened. What happened was he is alive. And it's incumbent upon us to marvel and to ask, why is that the case? So it's a philosophical objection, but it really doesn't carry its salt. All right? Yeah.
So I have a friend who every time I talk to her, she has some sort of scientific discovery to talk to me about or like ask me about and how it relates to God. And recently we had this argument on fine tuning, and her final like point before the conversation was over was basically, I believe that someday we are going to be able to discover some theory that explains fine tuning that's not God. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, I've heard that before. Sometimes this is framed in the sense of a God of the gaps objection, that really there's a gap in our scientific understanding, and what you're doing is just putting God in that gap. I don't think that's fair, because really what the naturalist is doing is putting naturalism in the gaps. They're trying to come up with philosophical explanations for what we're seeing. We're saying that we have a better, more reasonable answer to explain the data. Now, to say, well, one day we're going to discover this. Well, this, let me remind you, this is not a gap that has been closing as science has discovered it. The experimentation has been increasing. The explanations have been decreasing. The more we study this, this isn't a gap that's shrinking. This is a gap that's being blown wide open. The more we study this, the more cases of fine-tuning we discover. At one time, I remember being in a group like this, and one of the guys said, hey, man, you know, someday they're going to figure out the explanation for this. I said to him, I hope politely, imagine if I got up here and I said, I've got really good evidence for God. And someday they're going to find that evidence. Any questions? You know, I'd be laughed off. I don't know if this is a stage, but I'd be laughed out of here, right? To say, well, my worldview, eventually it's going to be backed up by science. We're not talking about eventuality. We're talking about actuality, where we're at right now. Yeah, it just seems to me that saying, well, one day this is going to get figured out, that isn't the trajectory, and we can't go based off of what's eventually going to be discovered. We have to go based off what we know. So, well, we're out of time. Why don't we take a break and pray? Yes, Lord, as we think about this, it really speaks to your grandeur, your infinitude, to think that you would surrender all that to come and to hang naked from a cross for each one of us is pretty astounding. We want to thank you from the heart for that. We want to pray, too, for people who are sitting here with us tonight who are still kind of on the edge. They're not really sure if they want to make that decision to come to meet with you here tonight. We pray that they would, not in some kind of a way where they feel that there's pressure or obligation, but just a free expression of the heart where they could call out to you, even at this moment, and just say, if you're there, I want to come and meet with you tonight. I want what Jesus did to pay for me. And we're so thankful for anybody who might have done that here with us tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.